Hello, this is Patrick from The Fundamental Principle. I'm here with Jerome, and
Thank you.
how you doing, bud?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
We've been trying to schedule this topic for a long time, probably maybe 2 months now. You know, Easter, Lent kind of got in the way. Just focusing more on the spiritual aspects and less about, you know, the politics and history. But so we have Arno with us to talk about Kolbe and the mysticism behind him. How are you doing, sir? Thank you for coming on.
Yes, I am. I'm doing well this Sunday evening. This is Good Shepherd Sunday. But yeah, this is a big important topic, especially for traditional Catholics in terms of how do they rectify, you know, obviously Maximilian Kolbe himself, and then how does that relate, obviously, to some of the bigger picture things that are being further elucidated? You know, we can thank Father Modsley, and obviously there's a bazillion other people who have delved into this topic of the death camps or whatever else, you know, you want to call them. So this ties right into a lot of that.
Arno, we've known each other for a while now, but if you could just introduce the listeners to your work and your Telegram channel and stuff. You're proprietor of the excellent Servium Telegram channel, but just tell the listeners briefly about yourself, if you would, please, by way of introduction and how you came to knowledge of the topic we're going to be discussing tonight.
Yeah, this is essentially my whole road into traditional Catholicism. Before I jump into that, but yeah, so essentially, I have been inspired by Maximilian Kolbe in terms of his, you know, efforts and his diligence. And so, you know, a lot of people would give kind of Fulton Sheen that credence that, oh, he was the kind of the big Catholic who was big on this media sphere, right? But I would give more of that credit to Maximilian Kolbe. Obviously, you know, television wasn't around as much to his time, but in terms of mass propaganda, or whether that's radio, print, etc., like all of these things needed to be done because it is a battle of information. You know, that's essentially where we're at, and that's what Maximilian Kolbe saw as well. And so that's kind of been my inspiration. So yeah, I run the Servium channel there on Telegram, and then I haven't done as much as of late, but I will post book recordings on my Faith and Movement channel in YouTube. But yeah, it's been a few months. So more or less, I've been posting sermons of traditional Catholic priests on YouTube at the moment. So yeah, this is very integral to me in regards to this topic, though, because really what got me into kind of this traditional Catholic mindset, because I was born and raised Novus Ordo, and then sadly, I was raised, I would say, I mean, Novus Ordo is essentially Protestantism once you get bare bones into it all, if you get down to the logic and philosophy. But that's essentially how I was raised. You know, you have your saints, you have your disciples, etc. And then everything else is kind of up to the wayside in terms of however you want to practice it. So I actually was exposed to Maximilian Kolbe through Instagram of all places. And so there were two very active accounts on Instagram at the time, Militia Immaculata Knight, and then another was Militia Immaculata. And then obviously there had been traditional Catholics with the SSPX Militia Immaculata, and they were posting all of the things that no one is privy to in the Novus Ordo in terms of, you know, that the Jewish question primarily, and then who are these people behind communism, right? And a lot of that is integrated, of course, into the Fatima message in terms of Russia spreading her errors. And so obviously, well, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I think it's necessary to understand that, like, Maximilian Kolbe was a Polish patriot, which is not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot of unfortunate stuff that's happened with Polish messianism, but, you know, there was this Catholic country that was destroyed by invasion from Russia and Germany, and that they asserted themselves, you know, to be their own country again is not necessarily a bad thing. but the people who destroyed, who tried to destroy Poland, were Jews. And the people who'd run the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, I mean, listen to our episode with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and the, you know, the long series he's doing of 200 years together with our friend Pete Quinones, about, you know, Schultz and Eats and the great Russian historian, you know, Nobel Prize winner, right? His last most important book was just how destructive the Jews had been in, you know, what's now Poland, Ukraine, and Western Russia, Belarus. And it wasn't Polacks who, you know, were part of the Red Army or the vanguard of the Red Army, you know, destroying the Polish church. It was Jews and pagan Asians. I mean, it was like Kazakh animalists and Uzbek Muslims and Lord knows what else. But the Jew was the hidden hand behind all of it. And, you know, by today's standards, Colby was an anti-Semite. I mean, just straight up, like way, way more strident than anything I've ever said. And I'm, you know, notorious, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's the thing is, and that's kind of how they've tried to rephrase that, right? In terms of like, well, he was just a man of his time, right? And that obviously that goes along with modernism, right? Well, that was just his time. That, of course, if Maximilian Kolbe lived in our present day and age, he, of course, would not be anti-Semitic. Like, obviously, you know, it's kind of funny. I've been reading more of his letters and writings that have been compiled. And so, you know, he makes direct references to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you know, numerous times. But in their little notes that they provide in their writings and letters that he has, so like, yeah, this is what he knew at the time, but obviously this has been debunked, you know, obviously in the present day and age. If he knew otherwise, he would have been enlightened, and of course he wouldn't have been this massive anti-Judaic anti-Semite. But that's besides the point. You know, it's the truth is the truth, regardless of the time or the age. And you can't deny that. And so that's back to like where I was from Instagram. Like, so these guys were posting about all this stuff, and then essentially I was digging more into it and wrestling with in terms of traditional Catholicism and Novus Ordo Catholicism. And just, it really came down to, in my mind, it was like the MI, the Militia Maculata of the Novus Ordo, would that have been an organization that Maximilian Kolbe would be proud of, or would he have even supported it? And I came to the conclusion that it would have been a resounding no. You know, it's clearly walked back from its principles for the conversion of heretics, schismatics, you know, Jews, and then particularly Freemasons. You know, the modern Novus Ordo does not do that at all.
The modern Novus Ordo doesn't even admit that Freemasons are a problem. I mean, this is the, you know, and something you mentioned briefly earlier, you know, we're in an information war, right? And Kolbe was, you know, the first man to use, like, he was very much like a Father Coughlin of his day, right? Like, you know, he was a man on the radio using the medium to try and tell the truth about the political situation in Poland and in neighboring countries. And, you know, we're engaged in that same information war, you know, 85 years later. But it's fundamentally the same players selling the same lies, you know?
Yep, exactly.
And it I mean, I always knew something was off just because I understood the JQ and things. But thanks to you and this document that you found, like, to take Max Kolbe, this Catholic crusader for Our Lady, and make him a tool of the Jew is just like Satan is laughing. It's so disgusting. It's vile beyond words, really, to take this saintly man and twist his death to Jewish purposes so that they can further undermine and destroy Catholic Europe. It makes me very angry. It makes me very, very angry.
So before we kind of get into the document, I kind of talk about that. I kind of want to make a warning or a, I don't know, what do you want to call it? But we can kind of talk about his sainthood. So the big thing surrounding Kolbe is how he died. And this document talks about his tuberculosis and heart issues. But do you, that's, he was a, he was, his, fictitious story around Colby is that he sacrificed himself for another prisoner. He's considered a martyr. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I thought martyrs, to be saints, they had to die for church teaching. How does that relate to his Novus Ordo understanding of martyr? We can talk about that, and we can kind of dive into the article.
Yeah, so they've rephrased it, right? So he's no longer just like a martyr for the faith, but they made him a martyr of charity in terms of giving up his life for another man, in terms of that higher charity, right? In my opinion, the higher charity is like, okay, what can I do to get someone to heaven? And so, yeah, there's examples of saints who have tried to offer themselves up to another person, etc. But that's not like the true martyrdom, in terms of what we've all grown to know and love, in terms of like, yeah, you've been persecuted for the faith, and that is clearly it. He was, again, according to the story, Maximilian Kolbe gave up his life for someone else, and he wasn't killed because he was Catholic, but he offered himself up. And so, yeah, they've tried to rephrase that, and that's a JP2 invention, essentially. And so it's nothing that's ever been recorded in church history, as far as I'm aware of, over the past 2,000 plus years, in terms of, is this martyrdom or not? And then so they made it a martyr of charity. So that's how they got around it.
Right. And then,
doesn't make sense.
Right. And John Paul II, for all the good work he did in the Solidarity Movement and, you know, fighting communism, right? Ultimately, you know, he was like rabidly pro-Jewish, and that like fatally undermined his papacy. And he was, you know, he had that 25 or 30 year stretch on the throne of Peter where, you know, the Holocaust narrative really set in stone, and he's the chief villain behind making Maximilian Kolbe like this symbol of resistance to National Socialism. And you know, I saw something recently, right, in Adolf Hitler in a speech saying, you know, we have our axis but also our allies, and you know, and he mentioned all these nations, Spain and Norway and Finland and Portugal and Croatia and Hungary. And like, you know, as the map gets colored in, it's Catholic Europe. Mm-hmm. It's Catholic Europe against the Judeo-Freemason alliance in Britain and in the Soviet Union. It was the Galatian Eastern Catholics in Ukraine. And it was, you know, the Greek Catholics in Greece. And that's who was fighting that war. And John Paul II, because he was, you know, poorly formed in the middle of a war, and frankly, you know, had a lot of weird Polish messianic ideas, just didn't tell the truth about that war. And it fatally undermined Western civilization and the church.
I do think we should, before we continue, define Polish messianic. Excuse me, I cannot talk that. I'm sorry, folks. Polish messianism. Before we continue,
please go ahead, Patrick. You know more about it than I do.
I was passing the
go ahead. Yeah. So, to kind of quickly summarize what Polish messianism is essentially, kind of originated in like the 1830s, like we'll just say mid 1800s, this ideology that Poland was going to be the savior of Europe. And then once you really get into like, well, who are these thinkers who are behind this ideology? You actually will find that a lot of them were Freemasons, Jews, who were espousing this level of nonsense. And so given that, there was a lot of interplay between Catholics as well, in terms of the people who were going to bring about, again, it was going to be Poland, but it was going to be this ecumenical front. It was going to be Polish Catholics, Polish Jews, Polish Protestants, Polish whoever, whatever you want to name it. These were going to be the people who were going to lead and bring salvation to Europe.
Which is, I mean, it sounds nice that, you know, that sounds, you know, like a wonderful thing. I know I've spoken about my bigotries in the past, and a lot of my bigotries come from, the aristocrats of Poland always bowing, always signing the loan before they make the sign of the cross. And this kind of plays into it with, you know, John Paul II kind of being the pinnacle of that mindset. But I guess we can get in the article. So this was, I'm going to post this on Substack. So this is original Chris Reed. We can tag his, Telegram in the show notes. It's an Australian Christian fascist. Did a lot of the legwork for this. I know he contacted the Auschwitz Museum for some of these documents. And then we had some friends who kind of disappeared in the last couple years. Mendel and Heinrich, they made a Substack. I think the Substack got gassed when Substack was updating their TOS and banning all the pro-NS channels. That's the original fundamental principle got lost in that too. I guess, where do you guys want to start with this article?
I'll let Arno take it.
Yeah, so I think in terms of where to take it, like, yeah, we could go many different avenues. But so, yeah, obviously, like, the common understanding is that Maximilian Kolbe was detained into Auschwitz, and, you know, from the common understanding that Auschwitz is a death camp. You know, anyone who goes in there dies, 6 million Jews, etc. And then on top of it, when you can name any other group, demographic, you know, they're all being slaughtered, right? So I think, again, we can refer to many different references in terms of what's essentially been debunked from the Auschwitz standpoint. Obviously, none of that makes sense. You know, they're trying to make 2 + 2 = 5 or 6 or whatever number you want, right? Or 2 + 2 = 6 million, right? In this instance. So that's really, you have to start. And that's, for at least in my opinion, as a traditional Catholic, you have to debunk that topic completely. Because once you debunk that, then everything else is on the table. And then, of course, this is where we get this lead-in into Maximilian Kolbe. So again, he gave up his life for a prisoner. The prisoner, apparently there was like a jail escape, and then they caught the guy, and then Maximilian Kolbe heard about it, and he wanted to offer his life. And so he went on a starvation thing for, what, a week or two, still alive. And so at the end of his starvation, they injected him with carbolic acid, which is a phenolic acid. So if you understand how phenolic acid will work, it essentially will cause multi-organ system failure because it creates an acidotic environment in the body. And because we have a strict pH balance in our body in terms of like buffers and whatnot, because obviously we have acids and we also have bases in our body. But this just completely overwhelms it, and it just causes, obviously, your whole organ system to fail. Okay, well, that's the common knowledge. But what we found, particularly, again, thanks to the legwork with Christopher Reed, you know, we actually have the death certificates of Maximilian Kolbe while he was detained in Auschwitz. And there's some interesting things that lead up to his death. One thing that I found particularly really interesting was that they were doing x-rays upon Maximilian Kolbe 3 times, and I think 4 times. If you look at the document itself, like, it has his numbers, but one of the numbers is off. That just could have been a transcribing error. But like one of them will say he's got like a bronchitis, but they're clearly taking X-rays of his lungs, and so we know Maximilian Kolbe had tuberculosis. You know, he was essentially operating on one lung, and so of course during war, and this applies to everyone. You know, it's not just Maximilian Kolbe, but obviously rations are short. You're not getting the proper nutrition. You're also encountering, you know, we know in his Dniepokalanow, they were housing, you know, Poles. According to Maximilian Kolbe himself and some of his own writings, they did house, you know, like 1,500 Jews, but they're also housing Volk, Deutsch, like in terms of like people who Germany would consider, you know, ethnically German. Maybe they weren't living in Germany at the time, but you know, according to their bloodline, they, you know, so they're housing all these different groups of people. And so of course it's just a perfect place for disease. And then obviously if you've had tuberculosis earlier on in your life, you know, it's only going to exacerbate on top of it, especially if you're not eating. So again, like there's two documents in here, you know, his death certificate, and then the other one is his autopsy. So again, it starts throwing this whole Auschwitz massive death camp into suspect. Like, wait, why? And this is where, you know, this is where we really picked off or started, essentially. It's like, why would a place that is supposedly putting them in the cremation chambers, gassing them, why would they have all this documentation for all these people? If they're just trying to kill them, what's the point of documenting at all? It doesn't even matter who they are, right? If the National Socialist Germans are the materialists that we are told to know and believe, you know, man, you know, humanity, you know, doesn't even matter, you know, in terms of, you know, the communistic understanding of man. You know, you're just like a pig. You're just a horse. You're whatever animal you are. You're just an animal at the end of the day. Why does it matter how we document these things? So the second document that really jumps out is the death of Maximilian Kolbe is attributed to myocardial insufficiency. It's just like, whoa. Okay, I thought carbolic acid was how he died. Sure, okay, carbolic acid causes multi-organ system failure. Myocardial insufficiency is something completely different than carbolic acid injection. You know, myocardial insufficiency is usually attributed to like a heart failure, essentially, right? And you can get heart failure from lung disease, right? So essentially your heart has to work harder to get oxygen. It starts growing in size, et cetera. It just becomes more inefficient in terms of how it's pumping blood. So it will get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's still not pumping blood as well as it should. And so yeah, we have this document here, or yeah, this page clearly states his death is attributed to myocardial insufficiency. And that's nothing that we have ever heard, you know, until recent, you know, I would say in the last 2, 3 years. This is the first time I'd ever come across it. I've never seen anyone else come across it, you know, in terms of mainstream Catholics talking about it. But no one is. And that's the question. Why?
So, I kind of give some context to the audience. You know, a lot of the concentration camps, a lot of the main the were starved due to the Axis supply line, or the Axis supply lines being cut by the Allies. They didn't get resources to these
They were
camps. Go ahead.
short of food, they were short of energy, they were short of everything.
Absolutely, but they still like chose to feed these prisoners. The humanity of the Germans, choosing to feed people that they were in camp, they were for whatever reason. We also need to keep in mind that Auschwitz is on a swamp in Poland, and August as a rainy season for southern Poland. So I think weather conditions probably weren't the best, especially if you're dealing with breathing issues and trying to recover from a any illness, rather. Any illness.
And I think another big aspect, too, that doesn't get mentioned at all either is the official letter of the Vatican, the Osservatore Romano. You know, they had a essentially a quick article about Maximilian Kolbe in terms of his death. And so what it says is that, again, he was a great Marian apostle of his day, but it says he passed away silently precisely 1 year ago, August 14th, 1941. And then it obviously goes into all of his accolades in terms of what he did for his life, you know, for the faith, you know, for the Eastern people in Japan. You know, he, of course, he tried to travel to China. He even had some stops in the Philippines. Like, you know, he was all over. But again,
it was his church that was bombed by the Allies as the nuclear bomb.
Yeah, correct. It's his Mugenzai Nusono, you know, essentially Nagasaki. You know, that's where he was at. That they chose for whatever reason. My opinion, like for whatever reason, the reason is because it was going to be the Catholic hub. It was going to be essentially the Vatican of the East. In terms of that light, you know, on top of the hill, you know, shining out, because, you know, the Japanese, you know, because of their love for order and tradition, like these things from traditional Catholicism standpoint, those things clearly speak to them, even though they were and still are, unfortunately, largely a pagan country. You know, they still honored, you know, obviously their ancestors, but they had a love for order, and that predisposed them to messages of the faith. You know, much like our European ancestors were. You know, they were predisposed, they were ready for that message to come across. And so I think that's why Father Maximilian Kolbe found, you know, Japan to be such a fertile ground for that message to be shared, even in the midst of a war, right? It didn't matter. Like, these people were going to convert. And so that's why they had to, unfortunately, eradicate them, because they saw the good work that was being done by a true Catholic.
Sure. Well, and so Kolbe joins the Friars in 1907, and basically continuously in Lviv, what's now Lviv, but Lvov, whatever, under the Polish pronunciation, from 1914 to basically 1945. So for 30 years, just this entire area is just destroyed by war and communism and famine and civil war and you know, all kinds of just awful stuff, right? And it's impossible, you know, if you destroy Iowa, you know, for 20 years of constant warfare, is it any surprise that Iowa can't feed people?
Of course not.
Right? Like, well, so that's part of what the problem was, right? And I mean, it's MacArthur was asked, or the Emperor of Japan asked MacArthur, should I become a Christian now that you defeated us? Like, we should, you know, should Japan become Christian? And MacArthur, the Freemason, said no. Right? If Japan had been victorious in their anti-colonialist campaign under the influence of Catholic powers in Germany and Italy, who knows what would have happened, but it wouldn't be the dying pagan society it is now, that's for sure.
Yeah, this makes me think, I came across a writing from Maximilian Kolbe in his Risers, Nipokalano. This was written in 1925. And so the title of his article that he wrote was, "What a Freemason Tells Freemasons About the Vatican." And so essentially, to just kind of quickly summarize what he's saying in this article, but it was essentially, so this is after World War I, right? So we've obviously had a massive change in order. We're getting more democratic ideals being spread. Of course, communism is, a big thing, of course, since 1917. But regardless of all that, after World War I, we still have the heads of state who are seeking the advice from the Vatican. And even Emperor Hirohito himself, he had an emissary that he sent to the Vatican, because that was still where order was kept, and that's essentially what these Freemasons have been, and unfortunately seemingly have undermined, that influence of the Vatican on the world stage in regards to politics. And so it's just like, how do you undermine that? And that's where, like, we start delving into World War II, obviously, right? And then obviously what happened after, World War II, we get who's the new kind of head of the stage. We get kind of the Freemasonic United Nations that becomes the default or the usurpers of the crown that the Vatican once held. But that's always been their goal. How do we undermine the Catholic place in society? And then Freemasons were always trying to do this by corrupting morals, make it easier to sin. It's okay to sin. It's okay to murder. That's essentially what they're saying. And of course we see that nonstop throughout, obviously communism's infiltration into, Eastern Europe. But of course we have all the democratic ideals that are, again, being spread throughout Europe too. Like, oh, see, more free, more choices, more options. You don't have to listen to the Vatican. You can go and have sex. You can do whatever you want. You can cut off your wiener. Obviously that was happening then too. not to the point where we're at now, I would say, in terms of from a technological standpoint, but those were all things where, yeah, just, you can do it because you can, and your human dignity allows that.
Well, I think that it's, we've seen with this this poor woman Shiloh Hendricks, right? That the late great Bishop Williamson was right. That this event that Max Colby is Saint Maximilian Colby is hijacked for is the basis of a new religion.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not the Catholic religion. It is not the Catholic faith that, is constantly worried about Mussex Carillion. And the first step to, America's one great spiritual contribution to the world, right? AA, the first step is admitting you have a problem. And, I think way too many people, especially in the Novus Ordo, they believe they're Catholic and they're just not. And this isn't me, from, some high and mighty place. So I only go to the Latin Mass. And no, I'm much like Arnold. I was raised in Novus Ordo and read myself into tradition and read myself into understanding, the necessity of anti-Semitism and race consciousness, etc. But this great saint, this man who uses radio, he was a fascist. he was not, this hug, love everybody modernist. He was a radical that agreed with me more than he agrees with anybody that's using him as a cudgel against people like us.
Yeah, I would say in terms of that, like, obviously in today's era, he would definitely be a radical. But even like during his time, he wasn't necessarily out persecuting people, right? Or whatever. All of his belief was is that the truth is the truth, and I'm going to speak it, whether in and out of season. It doesn't matter the time or the place. If I see you on a park bench, if I see you on the train station, that's what he would do. He would approach people. He would talk to them. And he would even go out and talk to Jews specifically. He's like, oh, hello, I noticed that you're you know, speaking Yiddish or, you know, whatever, if they're speaking Hebrew potentially. And then he would go and have a conversation with them. And he would go like, can you tell me about Zionism? And then they're like, well, don't you know? But he's like, no, I want to hear it directly from your mouth so that it affirms what I currently understand and believe. And then there's no way you can get around it. And so he was just doing this out of a form of proper charity, right? You know, in terms of the three virtues of faith, hope, and love is how the Novus Ordo will say it. I like to use faith, hope, and charity. In terms of the proper charity is you want to direct someone to the highest love, and that is the love of God, the one true God, you know, and of course that being Jesus Christ. That was his only way. He wasn't going out, you know, of course he was calling out their problems, but that was it. That's all. He was just noticing, right? as we would kind of commonly say now, it's just like, no, like these people, since the time of Christ, they have denied him. And we can go historically phase by phase in terms of where they have had a role in the degeneracy that has unfortunately happened throughout history. And they're always at kind of the back of it. And so one of the stories he would always like to use, you know, for getting conversions and particularly to spread, you know, spreading the miraculous metal was the conversion of the French Jew. Yeah. Alphonse Ratisbon. And so Alphonse Ratisbon, it was from a banker family in, I'm blanking on the French city. But that Ratisbon family was also related to the Rothschild family. And so essentially the story goes with Alphonse Ratisbon is that, you know, he was kind of like this atheistic Jew, right? I'm just kind of a Jew by name. I don't really understand whatever that faith entails. I'm just ethnically a Jew. And so, of course, I'm supposed to hate Catholicism and Christianity and Christ and the Blessed Virgin. But again, at that time, he was at least open to having conversations with those who would speak the truth. And so there was a man who reproached him. He's like, in a nice way, like, you shouldn't say these things about our Blessed Virgin. And so he gave Alphonse Ratisbon this challenge. He's like, you know what? I'm going to give you a miraculous medal. And then what I want you to say for 7 days is the Memorare to our Blessed Mother for 7 days. And so, of course, as a Jew, he balked because, you know, they have no faith. He's like, you know, fine. You know what? I'll play your game. We'll do it. And so he does it. And, of course, he's like, yeah, whatever. You know, I'll play this silly Christian's game. But at the end of the 7 days, he finds himself in a church where he is reciting the Memorare to Our Lady. And she appears to him in this church. I should have remembered this. But yeah, she appears to him in the church. And he has an instantaneous conversion. And so even Pius the Ninth, I believe, you know, they did their due diligence, obviously, in terms of, like, is this a miracle or whatnot? And they claimed that it was. Like, she did appear to this Jew. And he had a miraculous conversion, immediately got baptized. And the story of this man's life, so he became Father Alphonse Ratisbon. His brother, Father Ted, he was already a Catholic priest, Father Theodore Ratisbon. They actually opened the Priory of Sion with an S, Sion, not a Z. But they made their mission, the two of those priests, they made their whole mission. They moved to Palestine and they made their mission to convert as many Jews as possible. And that was kind of like the impetus for Maximilian Kolbe to spread the miraculous metal. Because obviously, if it can convert a Jew, an unbelieving, perfidious Jew, of course it can convert everyone else. And that was through our Blessed Mother.
So I pulled it up, his Wikipedia page here. So it's from Salzburg, Alsace, where he was raised, and his family was a secular banking family, like you mentioned. This Saint Andre de la Fete is where he had his
conversion,
vision of Mary. Yeah, vision. Yeah, you're right. But it's so. I'll add this to the show links. But there was also a lot of issues. I don't know. That's not really in the article, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit. There was a lot of issues in Poland. Being with Jewish occupation and Jewish control, with between the aristocrats and just generalized Jewish power coming in. So as he, we can kind of talk about his, how would you like to call it? The Jews pushing back on Kolbe's, newspaper, and some of the issues that came along with the newspaper and the ties with the Polish nationalist movement that was obviously was it with the where's the I can't find the name of the group.
National Radical Camp, or is that who you're thinking of? Or?
Yes, sir. So yeah, we can kind of talk about that. So it, from what, just talking to Chris a little bit, there was issues with this the Polish underground movement and Kolbe because of how anti-Semitic he is. Can we touch on that a little bit?
In terms of like his canonization, the discussion of his canonization, is that what you're referring to?
Oh, no. Well, I was more talking about why he was taken to the camp, the threats that against Kolbe, against the Jews and the Polish nationalists.
Yeah, so that is okay. I see where you're going.
So from his Wikipedia page, right? This is what he said. And this is under accusations of anti-Semitism, Kolbe's alleged anti-Semitism was a source of controversy in the 1980s after the aftermath of his canonization. In 1926, in the first issues of the monthly Night of the Immaculate magazine, Kolbe said he considered Freemasons as, quote, an organized clique of fanatical Jews who want to destroy the church, unquote. In a 1924 column, he cited the protocols of the learned elders of Zion as, quote, an important proof that the founder of Zionism intended, in fact, the subjugation of the entire world, and that not even all Jews knew this. Atheistic communism ceased to reach ever more wildly. Its origin can easily located in a criminal mafia that calls itself Freemasonry, and the hand that guiding all that toward a clear goal is international Zionism, which should not be taken to mean that even among Jews one cannot find good people. So he's just right. I mean, like, I don't know what to tell you. Like,
yeah, there is no way around it. And so, yeah, that's where we kind of get into this thread of, okay, why was Maximilian Kolbe in Auschwitz in the first place? And so something I think a lot that gets kind of ignored too is that Maximilian Kolbe spoke German. Why? Well, his father was German. Maximilian Kolbe was also offered German citizenship at one point. For whatever reason, he refused. But he was offered this, right? Because he could claim by blood to the fatherland, to Germany. And then, of course, because he is bringing up, you know, something that is integral to Polish ideologies of the time, you know, we'll just again revert back to Polish messianism in terms of, you know, the Jews had a big role in that. Freemasons had a big role in that. So here you have someone who's a staunch Catholic calling out Freemasons, calling out Jews. He was allied and spoke with the National Radical Camp, which was a fascist group in Poland who clearly took their inspiration from Italian fascism, and sure, by byproduct as well, you know, with Germany there too. And then the question that I think kind of gets glazed over too is like, okay, well, you have fascists in Poland, you have fascists in Germany, fascists in Italy. So what happened with Poland, right? Well, obviously the ruling class, like the aristocratic class, of course, they were filled with Freemasons, unfortunately. And so these people who believed in, you know, what Poland really was, not this aristocratic, ecumenical, everyone equal mindset, you know, no, we're Polish, we're Poland. You know, of course they were a danger, quote unquote, to democratic ideals, to society. And so there actually is, I have the article up, but I'm unfortunately it's blocked right now, but there actually is contact between the National Radical Camp and National Socialist Germany. And so this particular gentleman, yeah, well, I can see it now. His name was Alfred Lazowski. And so he was with National Radical Camp, but he also was part of the German intelligence as well. So there's this interplay between Polish people and Germany. And so that it would make sense, right? Because Kolbe himself, being ethnically German, he wouldn't just outright hate Germans. And even, again, when I was reviewing some of his writings and letters, he never denounces Germans or, you know, Germany as being this outright, you know, pagan evil empire that was, you know, being played up, of course, with Allied propaganda. You know, he was there, boots in the ground. He knew these people. He even wrote letters to people in Berlin. He wrote letters, of course, to there was a mother that he made an acquaintance to one of the guards, and he's like, "Hey, I met your son while I was interned in Amici, AMITZI, I think is the how you would spell that place." But he was interned there for 3 months. But yeah, he made acquaintance. Sounds like it wasn't too bad of a time, and he wrote to this man's mother, like, "I met your son. It was great. We were able to talk about the Immaculata. We were able to talk about the Virgin Mary." There's no inkling of any sort of hate that was in his heart at this time for Germans, for attacking Germany. You know, I think he understood the bigger picture that was at play. And again, it was Freemasons, right? He saw Freemasons when he was in seminary. He saw Freemasons marching in Rome. And then they will say, you know, they're essentially saying that the Pope will become the servant of Satan. Satan will crush the Vatican, etc., all that stuff. And so they're marching openly in the Vatican. And that was, again, that was part of his impetus as to why he started the Militia Immaculata, you know.
Right.
Look how active our enemies are. We must be as active, if not more active.
Right.
That's how we fight them.
And of course, Douglas MacArthur, I had to confirm this, but confirmed Douglas MacArthur, Grand Lodge of Ohio, free and accepted Mason. Like he was a Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So this is the man who told the Abenakis to not become Christians, but because Douglas MacArthur worshipped Satan.
Yep.
And so did Winston Churchill, and so did Joseph Stalin, and so did
FDR. Franklin,
FDR. I mean, like, this is not right in the choice, and only, you know, a Buddhist says Buddha is right, and therefore, you know, Christ is wrong. The communist, the liberal, the Freemason, the Jew start out with Christ is wrong. There's a difference. You're like, there can be wisdom found in the Confucian texts or Buddhist texts or whatever, because there's nature, right? Requires, you know, certain virtues, courage, thrift, hard work, you know, whatever. but we live in an anti-society today because the people who base everything off of a rejection of our Lord are the ones who won the Second World War. And that's why, like, we live in an evil society, right? It's not even, you know, we were the bad guys, and it's undisputable. And anyone that wants to, you know, argue, like, that's just not true. It's just not true. I've got to drop off. I want to thank you personally, Arno, for being here and for all your very, very good work over at Servium Channel and elsewhere. But I personally have to jet. So thank you, Patrick. And thank you, Arno.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad to be here. I know we could have got really deep into the weeds with this topic. But I think, like, obviously the crux is just, like, how did he die? Okay, well, he didn't die the way that they're told us. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of other backstory that obviously we could clearly delve into at some point, whether that's in the future or whatnot. But like Jerome was saying there, you know, essentially they've undermined truth and justice, that it's equality is the only thing that matters. And so they've undermined, in terms of what the faith even means, is equality is the only thing that gets you to heaven. It's you can't have a hierarchy, right? Everyone gets to heaven. It doesn't matter your religion. And so again, that's the threat, where all of these things are completely tied in together. And again, this is the world's understanding of the faith for the last 80 years, you know, we'll say since 1965, essentially. But prior to that, obviously, we have 1900 plus years of the faith being this very distinct thing. Yes, God calls all of us to heaven, but not everyone is fortunate enough to get there. It requires work, effort, true diligence to become a saint. Not everyone can be a saint. It's a matter of the will. You know, in terms of how do you become a saint, you have to will it. You just can't passively sit there on your butt and get to heaven. No, it requires day in, day out work. And, you know, they try to play this game that, no, you're doing good where you're at right now, right? That's kind of like the modern Protestant Novus Ordo. Well, no, Jesus will meet you where you're at, and he's fine with you staying there for the rest of your life because he loves you. That's the lie that they've told countless millions, billions of Christians, that you're fine where you're at. Don't do better. And that's, again, we see the repercussions of that throughout society, unfortunately.
You know, I obviously agree. And we're told that we must work out our salvation with fear and suffering. And anyone who disagrees with that is, I don't know, other than say wrong. Like, that's not that we're told that, you know, it's scripture that mm-hmm. can't be argued. But yeah, we can end it here. We can have you back on. It's been great talking to you. There's a lot to talk about.
We kind of opened a can of worms there with the even like John Paul II too, because I was like, ooh, that's a whole nother topic as well, in terms of, you know, who was he really? You know, was he a good pope? You know, how did he even become a bishop in Poland? You know, because obviously at the time when he became bishop, the communist powers that be were in charge of Poland. You know, so there's some obfuscation there too, in terms of, you know, potentially John Paul II being not necessarily selected by the communists, but he was going to be a bishop who wasn't going to call out their errors as much as other Polish bishops might have been at the time.
Well, I like any reasonable person love a good cliffhanger, so we'll end it there. God bless everybody for tuning in. I'm sure we'll have Arno on sooner than later. Thank you again, sir, for coming on.
Yep. God bless. Mary keep you.
God bless.